You're listening to Web Fiction World at webfictionworld.com.
Hello, and welcome to Web Fiction World. My name is Anna Hart. I'm here with my co-host Greg X. Graves to guide you through the many changing world of online fiction. Last time, I wasn't in the show, and Greg, what did you guys talk about?
We talked about monsters. It was a wonderful chat, and not just because you weren't there, but it did help. I mean, we talked about monsters with Riley Shirley.
Yeah, I'm going to pretend that you just didn't say any of that. Okay. Right, so this week, we're going to look at something a bit more serious, because I'm back. We're going to look at crowdfunding and alternative business models for artists and writers alike. Also going to have a reading as usual, but before we get to all of that, I'd like to introduce today's guest. Here with us is MCA Hogarth, artist and writer of far too many serials to mention, and I think she's won awards and she has some strange political connections, and we're going to find out pretty much everything about her. So Maggie, thanks for joining us today.
No problem, Anna.
I'm going to start off the interview with, I read it in your bio, you're the daughter of two Cuban political exiles. Is that right?
Yes, that's quite correct, actually. You know, my parents were very young when the revolution happened in Cuba, and, you know, there were several waves of people who left Cuba after that. The first wave were people who were kicked out or who fled for political reasons, and that would encompass both of my parents. In fact, my mother's entire family's property was nationalized, and they had to flee with nothing but the clothes on their back. So, yeah, I'm actually a first-generation American.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how does that, has that carried over into your writing at all, or?
You know, I never really thought that it did, because you grow up with these things and you don't really consciously consider them until you're maybe much older. But the older I got, the more I realized that, you know, you're a first generation American, you kind of look at things a little differently maybe than people who are here completely new or people who have been here a long time. And I always feel like there's a slight alienness to the society that I see versus the society I was raised in with the assumptions that I was raised with. So I think that it's unavoidable that there's that interest in the alien because of that.
Do you think that helps you analyze culture a little bit more because you have that sense of otherness?
I think it's unavoidable because well, not only that, but I'm married an American. So constantly kind of like doing this. I mean, in the beginning, I couldn't even, well, we don't even call that something in English. We call that something in Spanish, and I don't even know the English word for it unless I really think about it. And then, you know, my mother would say things and I'd try to explain, well, this is a word and it means this. And so I'm constantly doing this translation thing, and some of the terms just don't translate at all. And, you know, my husband would say, what does she mean by that? I'm like, well, that's what you call someone who's kind of wishy-washy. But, you know, the implication is like you throw them against a wall and they just kind of stick there and then they slide, you know? It's just really bizarre things that I realize there's no, not only is there no translation in between like the cultures, but the actual culture that my parents came from is also dead. They're from a dead culture. Cuba went on without them, you know, and became something that is alien to them. So the little bit of culture that they raised me in is also gone. And, you know, so I run into people who say, oh, yes, you know, we're Cuban and we have Cuban family. And sometimes I can't even talk to them. And so I get this sense of how time also affects our perception of culture. And it's a miracle to me some days that any of us have any context at all that we can get along with.
Well, we're all third culture kids in some way or another, I think.
Yeah.
Well, Greg, except for you, you're just boring and American.
Yeah, I'm bland. I have a crew cut and everything.
I mean, I experienced similar because my mom's Irish, my dad's Indian, and then I've just lived all over Europe, and it's always been this balancing act of trying to fit in and then, you know, trying to kind of explain to my parents what, you know, because I think kids assimilate with things a lot faster, I guess, than the older generation. And what about when it comes to like writing and art? Because you're both a writer and an artist. And was it ever like one of them came first? And so do you think of yourself as a writer who draws or an artist who writes? Or is it always been this kind of dual thing?
You know, I've always been trying to figure that out myself, and I don't think there is an answer. I think the answer is there are stories on the inside, and I just choose the way that gets them out the most effectively, and then that's where I am that day. But I think in basic, I am a storyteller. And as we all know, storytellers can use art as well as writing to get what they do done. Some of these webcomics I read, I'm completely astonished by how they can last for years and years and years and tell such incredible and moving and intricate stories a day at a time. And yet that's also art and it's also writing. And I don't know if we can separate them at some point.
Very true. And I mean, some people do it via song as well. You know, the folk songs of different cultures and things like that.
And I mean, you've written the only work of yours, I'll be honest. I've read some of the, admonishments of, I never know how to pronounce the word.
Kerestar.
Yep. And I've read a lot of Spots the Space Marine, but you've written like tons of things. Is there any particular story that's the closest to your heart?
No, really. I mean, it's just, you know, everything I write at that time is the thing that I'm supposed to be writing. So I guess at that particular time, it's the thing that means the most to me. And then I go back and I reread it, and I'm like, ah, I remember when this was the thing for me. And then I relive it. And then it's, once again, the best thing that I feel like I've ever done. And then, well, with exceptions, I mean, there are some things that I kind of are painful to reread because they're, just, they're incredibly young. But then I run into this issue where, you know, I published them so long ago, but they have fans and the fans like them just the way they are and would not appreciate me butting in and telling them that I think I could have done better, because as far as they're concerned, I did the job that I was there to do and they're happy with it. So, yeah, so I'm not going to disparage the older stuff because there are people who would tell me that that is mean of me and I don't want to be mean. So, but no, you know, some days you just want to write Space Marines blowing up aliens, and some days you really want to write calm, quiet little fantasies over tea, and you know, who knows what day it is until you sit down.
So that actually brings up an interesting question that I have a particular interest in with regards to revision. So where do you revision? I know that some authors say, you know, they leave themselves a window of a week or something where they will go in and change something, maybe leaving a note, maybe not. Whereas some authors will say, you know, it's done, it's finished, it's as good as in print, I'm never going to look at it again, or at least I'm not going to edit it again, no matter how much you want to. So where do you fall on that spectrum?
You know, that's kind of a hard question. I think my answer now would be different than it was 10, 12 years ago when I first really started throwing in the professional work that I felt like I was, you know, I was going to go at it professionally. But I think I've been doing this so long and I've written so much that at some point my first drafts, they're pretty close to what my final draft would be anyway. I might tweak a few sentences and all that, but I'm pretty happy with them the way that they come out. It's, I don't know if a long time ago I read a book by Damon Knight called Creating Short Fiction. I don't know if either of you have run into that book, but in it, he talks about how your subconscious is one of your best friends in writing, and he even named it. It was called Fred. He says that Fred, your subconscious, will solve your plotting problems, but you have to give things to him. So if you're so busy working on something, working on it, you never give it away to your subconscious to try to solve the problems that you can't seem to get around. So he would say, just say to yourself, just say out loud, Fred, I'm giving you this problem. You know, the story's not going where I want it to go, or I need to finish it and I don't know where to take it. So go for it. And then I said, you know, this is kind of a crazy idea, but I'm going to try it. And I actually sat down and I said out loud, Fred, I'm having this plotting problem. I have no idea how to fix it. Could you, you know, take it away and I'll leave you alone and I won't ask you any questions until you get back to me about it. And then I did that. And like a year later, I got an answer from Fred. And it was a good answer. It was a year later. And I said, well, that's great. Let's try that again. Can we speed it up a little? And then it was more like, you know, 10 months. And so I kept doing that. I'm like, I'm determined to you know, be a full partner with Fred. And eventually it got to the point where it's like, okay, a couple weeks, a couple days, a couple of hours, I go to sleep and I wake up and it's there, you know, the answer is there. And I've been doing it so much that I'm at the point where, you know, it's between a few weeks and a few hours, I'll get an answer back that says, this is how it's supposed to go. So I think the revising process in my head has gotten sufficiently streamlined that I don't really think about it too much anymore. I mean, I make the same typos and wordos that everybody does when they're going a mile a minute. But in terms of actual, oh my God, I wrote myself into this corner and I can't get out and I need to do huge wholesale editing revisions on everything. You know, I just don't do it anymore. Maybe that is for the best and maybe it's not for the best, but that's where I am.
As someone whose entire writing style is based on writing myself into a corner and having to figure a way out, as Anna can attest.
yeah, I was thinking that.
Thank you for not saying it. That actually makes a lot of sense. You know, you get to the point where you kind of learn how you write and you play to those strengths because not everyone writes the same way.
No.
Well, it's definitely a technique that I'd like to try, but I'm not sure I'd like to call my subconscious Fred. I don't think I'd be comfortable with that. Actually, your latest project, Black Blossom, I think you only finished it a few days ago, was it?
Well, the serial will continue running for about 5 or 6 weeks, but the actual manuscript is done now. And yes, it was a week ago about.
What's next then?
What's next? You know, I'm not quite sure yet. I have a couple of things that I could do, and I haven't decided because my actual work time is very much dependent on my duties as a stay-at-home mother. And either this coming year is going to be extremely busy, or it's going to be extremely not busy, or it's going to be extremely day job busy, and I don't know yet. So I don't want to really commit to anything really too big. Mm-hmm. But my plan was either to do a sequel to one of the existing books or to start a new project, which a lot of my readers seemed very enthusiastic about, which I thought would be a lot of fun, about a harvest god in sort of an urban fantasy kind of sense. But it's kind of like urban fantasy completely turned upside down, and I thought that would be fun to do. So I might try that instead.
That sounds coming with a whole lot of conflict already.
Well, you know, urban fantasy these days is, you know, snarky female narrator who kills things and has intimacy problems. And I thought it would be fun to do, you know, gentle, kind male narrator who wants a family and grows things in a garden. I thought that would be fun.
Actually, the changing subject completely as well. But I know that you were, I just remembered, because I know a couple of other online fiction authors have been looking into audiobooks, especially, I think, Isa, Kayfee, and Melissa Jones have been. And I think you recently made an audiobook for one of your books, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I used ACX to find a narrator for the aphorisms, and we just recently put that one on sale on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon, and very happy with the process. And the narrator was truly exceptional. I mean, just amazing. And the talent on ACX is pretty impressive. So I had a really good experience with that, and I have three more currently in production that I'm hoping to get out before the end of the year as well, including some longer ones, so that should be fun.
What's been your, like, fan response on audiobooks versus, like, your art and your writing?
You know, overwhelmingly, they love the narrator, which I don't blame them because he was just really amazing. But I think it's just completely, it's such a new thing that I don't think there's a lot of traction out there yet. There's more sales than I was expecting, but it doesn't have, you know, sales of a single title never really tell me much compared to sales of a broad group of titles, which is, you know, always been my strategies. Don't just have one thing out there. Have many, 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 many things out there. And then one thing will sell the rest of the things. So I don't really have enough data by my standards to really tell whether audiobooks are going to become some great taking off thing for me, or it's just going to be one of those small trickles that adds to the river. We'll see, I guess.
Yeah, I know a lot of, I've heard some other authors talk about how the audiobooks for them works out really great, but it also seems kind of like a crapshoot, you know. Like,
well, yeah. The whole business is a crapshoot. I mean, even when it was traditional publishing was your only thing, it was still a crapshoot. In fact, it was more of a crapshoot. So I'm perfectly happy with the way that things have come out, you know, lately.
Yeah.
I would not go back to that old system, period.
Yeah, in our industry, hard work actually can get you somewhere instead of hard work and then having to depend on chance.
Yeah, and, you know, just speaking as a business person, just doing business that way just makes absolute no sense for someone who actually produces a lot of work. I mean, I have a couple of manuscripts right now at traditional publishers because I can. I have, you know, like 7 novels left in the trunk that I haven't issued yet. So I decided to give a couple of them out to see, who knows, you know, maybe something will come up and I'll have a contract to examine and see if I want to go with it. One of them has been in Slush for 2 years, and the other is going on 2.5 years.
What?
These are big names, mind you. And I've done queries. I'm like, so, you know, where are we in this process? And I get back, well, thanks for your patience. You are now number X in line. And thanks for your patience. I'm not sure when we'll get to you, but we've set you aside for special consideration. And like, your special consideration, I mean, can't you just read the first 3 paragraphs and decide if you want it or not? I mean, I do that with stories in the bookstore all the time, you know. But if I get a no at this point, you know, I'll have been waiting 2.5 years with that manuscript locked up somewhere where I couldn't do anything else with it. And if you only write a book a year, you know, I don't write a book a year, but if you only write a book a year, can you imagine having to wait 2 years between finding out if you can do anything about with it? I mean,
yeah,
you'd never get anywhere, ever. So,
and you wouldn't get feedback. I mean, that's part of the nice thing about this. You get immediate feedback. Someone's like, oh, this character sucks. Well, I want you to think that character sucks. Good job. Back.
Someone sounds bitter.
Oh. Fantastic. Thanks for asking.
And Maggie, one of the things that's always interested me is you seem to really go into the create these amazing alien cultures. And what is it? The Jokka as well, I remember reading about at one point. It's just, where do you come up with all these different cultures and the different ideas? And is there any kind of basis at all in things you see in the modern world? Or is it just like you sit there and go, oh, I wonder what it'd be like to live on a world like this and what cultural restrictions would come up?
Well, it's, you know, everyone asks me that. And I swear I have a different answer every time they ask. But I think the alien cultures represent my attempts to solve a problem. And so, you know, I look at something and I say, what would it, you know, so many people unhappy with the role that society has given them based on their gender. What would it be like if the roles that you were given changed? Or might change. And then, you know, what would it be like to have a culture where lots of people, I mean, you know, lots of people, I mean, I lost my grandmother to Alzheimer's. So, I mean, a lot of people think of the Jokka and they think it's about gender identity. And in some ways it is, but it's also my question of how do you create a society that knows how to deal with people who lose their minds and yet are still alive? And so, you know, I ask these questions, and then once you have the beginning of a notion, then you ask all the questions that follow from it. Okay, well, here is one way to deal with it. What problems does that cause? What problems does it solve? What problems do those problems cause? And then you just keep going and then keep going. So I think for the most part, I just choose a theme or a problem, and then I just try to fix it and see if the fix works and if it works for us and what I could learn from it, I guess.
Wow. that's all I have to say.
I didn't expect that answer. It's really that deep or anything. I mean, it's just a what-if game in the end, and isn't that what science fiction is?
Yeah, that's true. I guess my method of culture creation is a lot more haphazard of, oh yeah, I probably need something, so I'll invent it now. And yeah, I don't sit there. And I always have to go back and do all the revision and be like, oh yeah, now I figured out why this works this way. But I need to talk to Fred.
Yes, exactly. relationship with Fred.
Yeah, we gotta work on that. Wow. How do you approach research? You do research on cultures that you kind of like. You're thinking, oh, this actual existent culture would be an interesting reflection, or I could fill in details with that. Or do you just kind of invent it as you go?
You know, I read about things. You know, I like nonfiction, and I do read, and I do research pretty ad hoc based on, oh, I'm about to talk about this in this manuscript. I better go figure out what it actually functions as in this universe. But that's mostly stuff like, you know, what grows in Florida in June, or what, you know, what do gunshot wounds actually do in the chest? I mean, very real based things. When it comes to designing the cultures, to be honest, it just falls out of my head if I try to do research. I have so much other stuff in my head that's made up that when I try to keep real things in my head, they just don't. And this just completely drives my family crazy because I never remember anything, even if it's like what I was supposed to buy at the grocery. And my mother-in-law watches me walk into the kitchen and stop and look around and go, I don't remember why I'm here. And she's like, you know, I have never met a young person your age with quite the problems that you have remembering things on a day-to-day basis. Like, well, yeah. So I've watched shows and I've read books and I've thought, wow, that's cool. And the conscious memory of it just vanishes. And if Fred's got it, then Fred just doesn't tell me about it. And that's Fred's bailiwick. So that's okay with me. But no, I don't actually go out and say,
life.
I don't go out and say I'd like these people to be like Indians or like the Chinese or whatever. I mean, I think I'd do a really bad job of that anyway. So I get to avoid all those nasty problems with, you know, people feeling like I've appropriated their culture that way.
Right.
True. Right. Greg, do you have one last question before we take a quick break?
I think I'm all set.
No, you're supposed to have a question.
I'm just asking about research. Okay, fine. How do you feel about tacos?
What?
Tacos. You didn't say anything that had to be on topic. Or you could just do what Anna does and say, hey, I'm changing the topic. How do you like tacos?
You know, I don't. So I guess that's a very straight answer for you.
Thank you very much. There you go, Anna. There was my question.
Perfect. Right. Well, let's take a quick break and have a reading. When we come back, we'll not be chatting about tacos. We'll be chatting about crowdfunding and alternative business models. But for now, here's a story for your listening pleasure.
The Calvary Captain, part of Flight of the Godkin Griffin, by MCA Hogarth, read by Fessworks. Duty puts paid to exhaustion. Where is Calvary? Quartered as expected. The captain's in the corner chamber, Gavin says, accepting the reins of the beast as I hand them to him. I pull my saddlebags off and let him lead the mount away. Traditionally, Calvary stays in the barracks adjacent to the stables in any major fort. Going into the mounted troop is a calling. No one would force a person to work with beasts unless he was comfortable with them, and few people are. It's too striking a reminder that we are only a few bloodlines removed from the beasthood ourselves, though it's a strict policy not to train mounts that might have resulted from the union of devolved people. Sometimes a beast has more intelligence in its eyes than can be easily accounted for. People who go into the cavalry are odd. I'm not sure what to expect of the captain other than eccentricity, and apparently arrogance, to be agitating supply on behalf of the company in lieu of its commander. I'm too tired to outfit myself fully. Being disheveled is an honored army tradition for officers anyway. But I do stop in a spare chamber long enough to wash my face and don my ivory corselet, and when I pin my slate-blue cloak back on, it's with the spiraling sword of the godson's authority. My route to the corner chamber takes me through the stables. The mounts are somnolent, but a quick inspection shows only glossy coats and healthy hides, shining eyes and well-oiled tack. At least the man takes good care of his creatures. Feeling only a little better, and still far too exhausted for this, I stride the rest of the way to the captain's chamber, knock smartly, and enter without being invited. My first impression is of more than one person, so before I even look at the captain, I say, "I'd like to speak to you alone, please." "Of course," a voice like butter and cinnamon deep in the hint of husky warmth my bones melt. I don't stagger because, by the gods, I'm the mistress commander of this company and I will not stagger, but I know that voice. As the people stream around me, leaving us alone, I look directly at her and my heart wobbles. "Sylphie! My new cavalry captain is Sylphie! Sylphie, who warmed my bedroll as only a half-grown young woman when she was 21 and I was 30. Sylphie, who had fit me like a piece I hadn't known was gone from me, like the last bloodline before Godhead. Sylphie, whose voice was a caress only a little less sensual than her fingers. Sylphie Fiveblood of Dale, who had broken my heart when she allowed her family to dictate whether she should dally in a non-productive union, instead of wedding and bedding someone who should produce the child Sixblood of Dale. If the years had been cruel to her, I could have stood before her with more aplomb. But she has grown into her lush, strong body and invested it with 18 years of character, insight, and wit. I can see it shining in her copper eyes as she meets my gaze and quirks that smile that still has power to move me. She takes my limp hands in hers and presses the side of her muzzle against them. Her breath falls hot and moist on the bare flesh of my wrist. "Enred, I've been waiting for you." I'm not sure what overcomes me more, the shock of seeing her or the shock that my feelings are still so strong. Taking care of her attitude is the last thing on my mind, and it needs to be the first. I should have come better prepared. I should have slept. I've done nothing to ready myself for this, and I'm not. There's been no one since Sylphie. I thought it was because I'd been busy, not because I still care. You can find more of MCA Holgarth at mcaholgarth.org. That was Precious Consort, off of the Lapfox album 5, found at lapfoxtracks.com.
This program is a part of the Webcast Beacon Network and is hosted on the Rampage Network. Follow us on Twitter at WebFictionWorld. Email us at webfictionworld@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 1-320-310-0922. Love the show? Please grab the iTunes or RSS feed. We are also on Stitcher.com with Stitcher Smart Radio, an on-demand service where you can stitch podcast and radio show feeds together for your own personal streaming service. The Webcast Beacon Network, covering and promoting creativity in the creative process since 2007. Webcomics, comic books, news, and web fiction at webcastbeacon.com.
And we're back, and there are no tacos in sight, so it's time to talk about the topic, today's topic, which is crowdfunding and alternative business models. And the reason we have Maggie on board is because Greg and I are pretty much not experts in anything except for tacos, so Maggie's the one who's going to be sharing gems of insight. Maggie, why did you get into crowdfunding, and like, what was your first experience with these kind of alternative business models?
Well, I actually started, maybe 12 years ago, I decided to make a go at becoming a professional writer and started submitting my work as recommended to all of the appropriate magazines that I felt my stories would actually have a chance of being bought at. And that resulted in a few sales and, you know, a few award nominations. And it was quite exciting. And I could not, for the life of me, make that momentum continue. I had stories that my readers were asking for more of. At that point, it was the Joker. And even to the magazines that I had sold before, I couldn't sell new stories about them, even though I had fans who were asking for them. And I asked the editors, you know, why aren't you buying these anymore? And one of them told me, you know, I really love them, but I've read so many of them that I don't know if I can judge clearly if they're sufficient for someone who's never read one before as an entry into the universe. And I said, wow, that's a painful problem, but can't you just buy it anyway and then see if it works? And the answer to that was they just honestly couldn't. They had become so accustomed to the universe that they didn't feel like they could figure out how to introduce it anymore to someone new. And so I had all these existing fans who wanted something that the editors would not buy. And they had good reasons for it by their standards. And the readers had their good reasons. And I was in the middle hoping to make money and making none and hoping to get stories to people who cared about them and not being able to do that. And that was very frustrating. At the time, there was no ebook revolution and there was no real way to capitalize on that. I had started keeping a live journal as a form of blog before there were blogs. And I got onto this crazy idea of just writing a throwaway novel and putting it online and seeing if I could collect tips for it. And that was in 2004, I guess, before crowdfunding was even a word. And so what I would do is I would put up a segment and then I'd allow people who had tipped me to be able to vote on the next segment. And usually the choices were kind of, you know, they weren't like world altering or story altering. It was, you know, do you want it to rain tomorrow? Or do you want, you know, the girl cuddle bath scene, or should I cut it? I mean, you know, things like that, that I thought were kind of a fun thing to give people the opportunity to throw in their two cents. And so I ran that book for 4 or 5 years, I think, and made a respectable amount of money on it. And then I realized I made money on it. You know, this is more than I had been able to do with traditional writing for years. For years, I had been pouring money into traditional writing by paying exorbitant amounts to send manuscripts around that were rejected and came back to me and then do it again. And I'm thinking, well, okay, I've made money And people have read my work on this side of the accounting ledger. And on the other side, I have spent money and no one has read my work. That did not seem like a very difficult choice. And yet it was very hard because at that time, to be self-published was to be worse than nobody. You know, you were a pariah who would never, ever get the attention of people who are worthwhile. And it didn't matter if you had actually published beforehand. It just meant that you had washed up since and that nobody would ever want you again. So it was very hard to let go of that sense of, you know, but I want to be somebody by other people's standards and realize, well, I can either be someone by their standards, which is at this point a nobody because nobody is buying the work, or I can actually have readers and maybe make some money. So it took some time, but I kind of came over finally completely to the other side and I haven't left it yet. I mean, I haven't said no to traditional publishing. I have some manuscripts floating out there, but the business model is offensive to me as a business person because it just doesn't make much sense. I mean, I've worked in business for so long that I look at the actual industry and think it's amazing to me it makes any money at all. I mean, it's just not very logical. So, you know, that's not a reflection on the editors or the agents or the publishers. It's just a reflection that the way that the industry has grown and the habits that it has and the business practices just, they're nonsensical and they're very difficult to make a living with. So I'm not really wedded to or invested in that side of the market at all, such as it is.
Do you think, though, you kind of, well, lucked out by being perhaps early to the crowdfunding scene, because someone starting out now might face a lot more competition with other authors trying to, you know, do crowdfunding projects. And so there might not be as much enthusiasm. Or do you think that that's not the case and that, you know, if you have the will, that there's a way?
You know, I honestly don't know, because like those poor editors who had no idea if they were buying the story that no one could understand as a first story, I don't know what it's like to break in at this point. I don't even know if you break in so much as you wade into a vast ocean and you're surrounded by water. But that's always been true of any art form at any point. I mean, there's always going to be more people making art than, you know, you could encompass in your arms. I mean, most human beings make art. And your goal really is just to be happy with the part of the pie you end up with, I guess. If you learn to be content because a handful of people have read what you offered and it meant something to them, I think it won't really matter that you're not a Kindle bestseller or whatever. And I think chasing that enoughness is really important for any artist that's trying to make any kind of name for themselves.
I actually wanted to hear your thoughts on, I've never used Kickstarter, but my brother was at this conference in Cambridge last week called Ignite, and it's all for entrepreneurs and startup companies. And someone asked one of the keynote speakers, a venture capitalist, what he thought of Kickstarter. And he was just like, that just like stuff like that doesn't work. Obviously, as a venture capitalist, that's what he's going to say. But, you know, you've had success with Kickstarter and you know, what is it like? What's your trick? How do you do it?
What's my trick? I don't think there is a trick. I think the most important advice I would give or have received about Kickstarter is a statistic which I have observed and which other people have observed independently, which is that you're only going to get maybe 10% new people from Kickstarter to fund your project. The other 90% is going to be people you already know or who already know you. So if you do not have a fan base that can support the size of the project you're trying to fund on Kickstarter, you should not count on Kickstarter finding those people for you. So, for instance, most of my projects, the 90% of the money has come from fans who I already know. I recognize their names. They already have bought other things of mine. They've sent me mail. or as a result of their efforts talking to people that they know. And, you know, I think if I had tried to fund, you know, a $500,000 media empire via Kickstarter, I would have been very disappointed because my fan base is not $500,000 rich in, you know, discretionary income. So if you are going to do Kickstarter, you should have a good sense for how many people you can command, you know, through your social media, through your existing fan base, to think that something is important enough to fund it, because you cannot count on going viral, and you cannot count on Kickstarter to supply most of the people who are going to be giving you money. If you keep that in mind, it is an excellent way, as long as you are rigorous about your accounting and your production costs, to earn lump sums of money, which is one of the things that we really were absent a way to do easily in crowdfunding until Kickstarter came around. So I'm really glad that they're there, and they've made a huge difference for me this year, just from a revenue perspective. So I'm all for it, but you definitely have to go into it with a sense of what is possible.
That was actually going to be my question, because Kickstarter has that kind of, I don't know if it's actually in their marketing materials or not, but I've heard a lot of entrepreneurs say, oh yeah, it gets you all sorts of new exposure and new fans. And like what you've just said and confirmed that I've heard from other people, it's that you don't actually get the new fans. You get a few, sure, but it's the same kind of exposure you get anywhere. A couple of new people find you every time you do something new.
It's true. But I will say, I have picked up some people for my first Kickstarter project who have followed me to the next two. And those were new people from Kickstarter who nevertheless seem to have been converted into existing fans. So I think that you can build momentum on Kickstarter. If you continue to do projects, you will spread yourself in the same way that, you know, the more you blog, the more people will find you. I think the more projects you do, the more people will find you. So it's useful to think of Kickstarter as something that you need to invest in order to get return, like anything, really.
And do you find there's certain projects that sell or that encourage more interest than others? Like, have you tried kickstarting artwork versus writing, or is there any kind of difference in the levels of interest?
Well, I only have 3 projects to base data on, so I'm not going to make any sweeping statements. But the art Kickstarter was kind of an insane experiment, and wow, completely unexpected, and a great lesson learned in terms of what to do when your plans get wildly exceeded. Because I set a goal, and I think we exceeded it by like 500%. And so when I built that project, I wanted to do maybe between 10 to 15 little sketches for people. And that would make me enough money, I thought, to go off and buy like 3 or 4 markers. And I would be happy with that. And I even built the project 10 days, only 10 days to fund it, and a very small amount of money. And I presume that, you know, I would maybe get 10 to 15 people, and that would be perfect. And then 52 people showed up. And I had not made plans logistically to do 52 sketches for people, much less package and mail 40 packages in and outside the US. I mean, I had set aside enough time and overhead to deal with 10 to 15 people, and now I had 50, and that was a big deal. But I honestly didn't expect in 10 days for it to become 500% funded. And I think that was just a result of people looking at it and saying, hey, you know, if I throw this really kind of inconsequential amount of money at this person, I'll get a cool doodle in the mail. That sounds like something I could do, and it would be kind of minor expense-wise, and it would be fun. And so the funness of it, I think, and the personalizedness of it, and the, you know, the excitement of it, I think just... I still have no idea exactly what happened with that project. So I'm planning a second art Kickstarter in a very different mode to see if art just creates different kinds of reactions from people than fiction. I would imagine it would, because it's more it's easier to invest in art because you look at a piece of art and you know pretty much instantly whether you like it or not. Whereas with fiction, you kind of have to read something, and that requires you to invest yourself in it more than a couple seconds. And I have funded like 3 fiction Kickstarters myself. And of those 3, you know, one of them I liked, one of them I didn't like at all, and one of them I was kind of like, oh, this is okay. So even me, you know, rolling the dice, you know, fiction Kickstarters, I think I'd much rather fund something I could instantly figure out if I really liked or not. So I think that has something to do with it.
And are there like alternatives to Kickstarter, or is that really like the best venue?
There are alternatives to Kickstarter. I think there's at least 2. I know Indiegogo, and there's another one that I've forgotten the name of, GoFunds or something like that. But the one that gets in the media and the one that everybody talks about is Kickstarter. And to be frank, the tools on Kickstarter and the interface and the website itself is so polished and so easy to use and so much better that even if you're going to go to some other website, it's going to be less enjoyable an experience even to set it up than doing it via Kickstarter. So, you know, you can go and find the other websites to do it, but if you choose to, you have to stick with it, because as I said, you get a momentum going when you stick with one site. And so the people who find you there can continue to follow you, that you lose if you switch sites. So either way, you need to just choose one and stick with it.
Wow. I'm feeling inspired to maybe give it a go myself at some point. Greg, are you going to do some taco kickstarting?
You know it. I feel downright educated right now.
You know, there are food Kickstarters.
Oh man, I'm there. I'm going to start a taco Kickstarter. It's going to be the world's greatest taco. Everybody gets a slice.
There are a lot of beer Kickstarters too.
Wow, also down with that. So, how did you decide like what you how did you first of all how did you construct your Kickstarter? You might not be familiar with it. And then how did you decide what your goals were going to be and what your, because you have to like set benefits for your benefactors, right?
That's correct. You know, all this is just business accounting, business math. And you have to be very aware of your overhead when you do a project like this. For me, the way that I do it is I look at what I want to fund and I sketch out the cost for it. You know, say I want to do a print book, and I say, well, what are the costs of doing a print book? I need this much for the editor, this much for the layout person, this much for advertising budget, this much for the cover. So I lay all that out, and then I get a number. And then that number, I add an amount for my costs of my time and, you know, my living expenses, because there's no point of doing this art thing if you're going to spend your own money to feed yourself while doing it. I mean, the point here is to make a wage. So I add my wage on top of that, and I get the cost of the project. Then you have to choose a number of prizes to give your backers, and then you have to calculate the costs of all those prizes. So say you want to do postcards with the cover art on them. And the postcards, you know, are $1 each to buy, and they are about 50 cents to mail in the US. So you have a cost of about $1.50 plus how much time it takes you to write out everything on it. So, you know, maybe $3 or $4. So the actual prize donation level for a postcard has to be enough to cover the cost of doing the postcard and to give you some money towards the actual project expenses. So if that postcard costs you $4 to create and then in time-wise to get together and send out, then you only have $6 to apply towards the cost of the project. And every single prize that you have to go through and make that calculation. And then you have to make sure that each prize is not detracting money from the actual cost of doing the project. Oof. Or else you'll end up having to pay for the actual prizes and the project out of your own pocket, and you don't want to do that. So most of Kickstarter creation for each project involves doing a lot of cost analysis. because if not, you will be in deep trouble when you fund completely and then discover that you don't have enough money to cover both the thing that you've promised to make and all the pretty prizes that you're sending to people based on that thing that you were supposed to make with the money that you now don't have because you didn't calculate correctly the cost of what you were doing. So,
was it intimidating to not only were you funding, are you trying to get funding for a major project, but was it intimidating at all to have to also produce these, the gifts or the benefits?
You know, not really, because I like merchandising and I've been doing this for so many years and I have a little inner marketer who really enjoys doing stuff like that because, you know, the real key to doing that sort of thing is to think, what would I like to have? And that's a fun question to ask yourself anyway. It's like, oh, you know, I wanted to give money to this artist and they were going to give me something cool. What cool thing would I really love? And then you sit down and brainstorm ideas of, you know, how awesome it would be. I'd love to have a cameo in that novel, or, you know, I'd love to have my name in the back of that book, or, you know, I'd love to have a postcard signed by one of the characters, you know? And so you have fun doing stuff like that. And I think as long as you keep it, keep a perspective on it that's as much about satisfying your inner consumer as it is about worrying if anybody else will like it, that you really don't find that it's quite as intimidating as you thought it was.
Cool.
I think my only conclusion from this conversation is that when I start a Kickstarter project, I'm going to hire Maggie as a consultant.
It is on my business card. I do have a business consultant line on it. And I do write a business column. So
for the Three Jaguars, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, I do. I would have loved to kickstart that book too, but that got rejected. So,
I'll throw some money towards it. I've read your posts and they're actually quite informative. So, I'd recommend that our listeners check them out if they want to feel a little bit humbled by Maggie's knowledge.
No, it's not humbling. It's just the kind of stuff that you have to learn when you do business analysis and marketing stuff in actual corporate. So I just took it all out and plugged it into art and saw what happened.
Well, I've kind of run out of questions. Greg, do you have a relevant question that's not food related?
Not food related. Can it be drink related?
That's relevant to the discussion at hand.
Okay, fine. I got one. Seriously. Do you drink 7-Up or Sprite when you're setting up a Kickstarter?
I don't drink soda. You keep batting out with these food questions, Greg. Well, okay, I do have a question that may inspire your question, which is, you asked me a lot about Kickstarter, but not so much about other forms of crowdfunding.
Yeah.
Is that something?
Yeah, what other forms are there?
Well, I have always sold my cereals, which has always worked very well for me. That's my grocery money, in the sense that I usually post one post for free. So every week you will get, you know, a segment of the cereal, whether there's money or not. And then I give people the opportunity to buy additional episodes that week if they want to read faster. And then if enough people pool their money together, then I will post it for everyone to read. And that has worked very well for me as a model for many years. And I think I've used it for the past two serials, I think. The past three. So that one has worked for me. And then I also did one where I required a cent per word price for each post that I made. And that's how I did the aphorisms and the admonishments, which were I needed at least 5 cents a word before I would post those things. And that paid for those two. And then there was the choose your own adventure style. If you tip me, then you can vote on the story thing, which I did with the first serial, which is now a paperback book that was issued by Sofa Wolf Press earlier this year. So in addition to doing that serial for tips, I also went and sold it to a small press, which was nice.
Oh.
So there are a lot of ways to do that. I think, you know, there are as many ways as you can imagine to crowdfund writing online.
I guess the main issue thing to get right is pricing then. Because I know that Stephen King did some kind of paper chapter thing with one of his stories, but then that failed miserably. Because he kept charging, what was it? He kept charging more and more per chapter.
Yeah,
and I think no one wanted to pay for it. And
well, I would not recommend changing the price gratuitously. I do know Cecilia Tan, who writes Darren's Guitar Chronicles. She used to offer a Saturday segment if she got tip succeeding. I think it was $15 or $10. And then this year she went to $25 because she said, this is the amount of work that it takes me to do an extra chapter each week. And so I can't really justify it for less than this. And I think that's a completely fair price. And I think she explained it very well. So I think it's all in the way you put it forth to people.
People are also more likely to give a bit to, well, trust us rather than Stephen King going, I need loads of money. It's like, you already have loads of money.
I don't even have a third vacation home yet, so I really don't know what the problem is. now, did you, when you were doing the serial, was this a new serial that you planned ahead with? I'm going to offer my readers the chance to buy essentially future installments ahead of time, or was this something that you added on to a previously free series?
Oh no, this was definitely during the time that they were running, because once my serials are posted online in their entirety, they're there for anyone to find for eternity, because I consider those free advertising. All the payment sections, the payment deals are just for the, what you pay for is the acceleration of the reading experience. So, you know, when we talk about pricing, you have to keep in mind what you price is a product, and you have to decide what that product is. And in terms of the actual serials, the serial itself is not the product. The serial is free. What is not free is the time constraint. So what I'm selling when I tell people for $15, I will post this earlier, is the earliness. And that is what people pay for. And I think when you explain it that way, people are more willing to pay for it because they understand, okay, well, I'd get it for free anyway. So what I'm really need to make a decision on is it worth the money to me to read it faster? You know, once they understand exactly what it is they're paying for, it doesn't feel unfair because they understand what it is. So I think productizing is the thing that most artists stumble on when they try to figure out how to ask for money for what they do.
Yeah,
I never progressed further than the putting up a PayPal thing and going, if you like the story, give me tips, which did work, but it wasn't, I guess, as planned a business model as the different things you've discussed.
Well, tipping does work, but people forget to tip. You can turn tipping into better money by offering subscriptions. I do subscriptions for my serials, and I sell that as a way for people to fund the serials acceleration without having to think about it anymore. And I have several people, more than several actually, who prefer that option because they don't really want to think about having to tip me. They'd rather just consider me an expense that they just budget for, you know, when they're doing their monthly budget, and then don't think about it anymore because it just does it by itself. So, you know, one of the classic marketing strategies, the aphorisms of marketing, is never make it difficult for people to give you money. And they don't really like to be reminded. If you remind them, they'll give you money, but they won't feel as good about it as if you just give them an option to pay you without having to think about it.
Wow. That's
a great point.
I just say wow this whole time. You've impressed me.
I know it sounds kind of Machiavellian, and it's not really that way. I think people people know that art is important to them. And when they read something every day, you know, they have a webcomic that they check every day, they have a serial they read every week, they understand this is part of the stuff that is part of my daily life that enriches me and makes me happy, makes me feel good, it entertains me, and that's important to me. And I wish there was an easy way for me to make that appreciation clear without having to really think about it or do too much trouble or worry about it so much. You know, for every person who wants to make a personal connection with an artist, there's someone who's too busy to make personal connections with all the people that mean something to them. So, you know, your goal when you're doing business as an artist is to cater to both those people, the people who want that personal connection with you and want to tip you in response to a comment they've made to you saying, you know, this meant so much to me, I'm sending you a tip. They want the personal connection. The person who just says, I don't really want to be in the spotlight. I don't want to think about it, and I don't want to be known. I don't want a fuss. But I do want to give them enough money to buy a cup of coffee. You know, you have to do something for those people, too.
So. Or a taco.
Right. Or a taco.
Well, I think we've all been given quite a bit of food for thought throughout this show. Definitely. Greg, do you have any words of wisdom, or are you just going to keep talking about food?
Well, I was just going to say that you were talking about how you've just been going wow this whole time. I always keep a sheet of notes in front of me, and I just have the word wow written in really big letters. And every time Maggie talks, I just color it in a little bit more. So.
Okay, now you have to help me here, okay? What is it that I'm saying that is so... I mean, I can't look at it from your perspective and see what it is that you're seeing. So what is it that's so different, I guess, about what I'm saying?
I think it's fairly unusual for people who consider themselves authors or artists first to step back and look at it from the business perspective and to, you know, plan their writing as in the business way, which is what we should be doing and what we all say we do. But I think... Or at least I'm guilty of, I just go, yeah, I'm a writer first, and then I think about the business later. So to then shape the writing almost to the business, I guess it makes sense, but it's, I don't know, it makes more sense when you say it the way you say it.
Yeah. Well,
I guess the important thing is the writing does come first, and the art does come first. But once you've done it, then your choices for how to get it to people who would appreciate it pretty much circumscribed by the society that we live in, which is, you know, which deals with money as a way of showing appreciation and of supporting people. So, you know, the writing is important, and you should put it first. And, you know, I've never written anything strictly because I want the money. You know, I've always written the things that I want to write. But once I'm done, then my task is to get it to people who appreciate it in a way that makes them understand that it's something valuable, you know?
I guess.
And for us, you know, something that's free is not necessarily understood as something that's valuable, especially in art, because people need to learn that artists need to eat just as much as anybody else. So, I mean, but not tacos. Sorry, Greg.
Killing me over here. I'm going to prove you wrong. I'm going to spend all
okay.
I ever make on writing just on tacos. That's a promise. Find $1 million, I'm buying $1 million worth of tacos.
Well, at the moment, what is it going to be? You'll buy like half a taco, Greg.
Yeah. Just lettuce.
Right. Well, I think we should just wrap it up. I think before this degenerates further, we've said everything that needs to be said. So thank you, Maggie, very much for joining us today and sharing your thoughts with us. It's been a very wowing experience.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, yeah, that's the end of our show today. So next time we have, the topic is as yet undecided. If you have any ideas or suggestions, please don't hesitate to drop us a line at webfictionworld@gmail.com. We'll also soon start recording shorter newscast episodes, rounding up the latest happenings in online fiction. So if you have any milestones or any news to share, just drop us a line and we'll give you a shout out. That's it for now. thanks again to our guest and everyone tuning in. My name is Anna Hart. You've been listening to Web Fiction World. Until our next show, keep reading, keep typing.